Hello and welcome to another episode of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, hello everyone. Happy Dome update slash new AD eventually slash Bay Birds and Bayhem on tour week.
Yeah, some of those things. We as always, it's been an eventful week in Syracuse sports. It's kind of what goes on around here. Every time you think that things are calming down, there's nothing to really discuss, something else occurs and stops us from talking about Tulane's new football uniforms.
Are we not? Should I?
We'll get there.
Okay. So that's all I really prepared for today. I don't know anything else.
Just read up on the new uniforms. Speaking of uniforms, and again, derailing before we even get into it, Pitt's new uniforms are awesome. To be honest, I know a lot of teams, including us, are going kind of the new age kind of Nike route and doing a lot of jagged edges and, you know, fluorescent colors and all this other stuff. And it seems like Pitt goes the other way, goes back toward tradition. Obviously, Pitt's script returned last year, but the uniforms, I think, really turned out nicely. And that's the only nice thing I'll ever say about Pitt.
Yeah, I think they're kind of doing that, like, throwback by way of, like, new age thing that's some teams have done with. They have, like, the matte helmets and a couple of the other things. Like, you can tell they're definitely 2016 jerseys, but the stripped is obviously, like, the best thing they have going, which is a big upgrade. And I also think they look really good, which is good because for them, because Pitt's uniforms have been pretty bland for a while, I think. So, good for the Panthers.
Agreed. Yeah, like, I think bland is something that you can do if you're really good and that's what you're known for. I don't think it's something you can do if you're a perpetually 6-6, 7-5 team. And, you know, that might apply to Syracuse too, to be honest, one day. We can dream at this point. And yeah, I just don't think that bland is how you can go there, because if people are looking for you on TV, and this is kind of like the Boise State model a little bit, and maybe Oregon kind of put their eggs in this basket as well, is like, if you want people to notice you if you're switching channels, you can't be bland. Not to say that people are going to notice the Pitt uniforms while switching channels, but, you know, Boise State, they made the blue turf almost entirely because they were dealing with, you know, late night games and odd channels. And the only way you were going to stop on a Boise State game when no one knew who they were was having blue turf. That obviously worked out pretty well for them, as did the quality product on the field. And now that's kind of a standard bearer for, you know, brand through television. And obviously it's birthed a whole lot of other gimmicks that have gotten people to stop or care or, you know, commit to your school.
Shout out to Eastern Michigan. The Gray Turf is going to save that program.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense why Eastern Washington and Central Arkansas would also dye their own turfs, because their games are rarely on television.
I don't know. I
think the concepts, yeah, afterward have missed the original point. Which,
well, people are going to do what they're going to do. I mean, I think those all happened, like, kind of soon after the blue turf, so you had to expect it to, like, a couple schools to jump in that wagon.
This is fair. Coastal Carolina's got the teal turf. They're going to be joining us in FBS next season.
I forgot about that.
Chanticleers. We have another random school that we can talk about ad nauseam.
Future potential American Conference replacement member.
Highly likely. But back to Syracuse. Dan, now, Dino Babers has had a rough go of it for the last week or so. I mean, finding out from the media that your boss was fired, knowing that he's the guy that brought you into the door, doesn't really make you feel great, I'm sure. And then yesterday, he didn't catch any flack for it, because obviously everyone, I think, understands Dino Babers' whole shtick, but him basically saying, if you have enough of an ego to think you deserve 44 when you walk in the door, well, we'll piss on him. Now, there's only one way to take that to me, and then that's positively. I don't know about you. I'm assuming you probably feel the same way.
Yeah, I'm fine with it. I mean, everyone's going to have their own ideas. Obviously, if it wasn't like an issue that people had different thoughts about, we wouldn't have the debate every year. I'm sure I'm not the only one who thought, the first time I saw the tweet with that it was supposed to be passed, like, we'll pass on that kid. I didn't actually think he said piss, but he did.
He's so, serious.
An interesting turn of phrase. But no, I mean, I kind of agree. Like we, and it's a little bit of a different step back. Or, I don't know. I think with like the Schaefer regime, obviously they were pushing the 44, and they thought they had a guy in Robert Washington who, to you know, for we can criticize or not, like he at the time was a big time recruit and probably would be the time that we would give 44 to. Obviously, none of that worked out on either side. So it is interesting to see, you know, Babers kind of taking a different approach, but I don't think it's going to, I don't know, I don't think it resonates as like some, a, you know, we're only going to go under the, go in as the unheralded, you know, after the unheralded people, like some people kind of accuse the Marone tenure of being. But it does seem like more of a, you know, there is more to Syracuse than like these three players who played 40 years ago. The brand is stronger than just 44. And he also, like, at the same time, he didn't take it off the table. He just said, you know, if there's going to be a 44, he's going to have to be like a really special player. And it kind of, it almost like he almost insinuates there that it might be a thing that's earned rather than given as a recruiting tool. So I'm glad that we can find our ways back to the same debates we've been having for 20 years now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that anything changed for anyone based on what he said there. I know the debate kind of started in the comments today, and for those listening yesterday, and then faded out a little bit. I mean, for me, I think it can be used as a recruiting tool, but not for a player to be guaranteed it. I know that this was a debate around 22 as well with lacrosse, Jordan Evans in particular. It's that I don't think it should be used as if you come here, you get this. It should be if you're good enough, once you're here, you can get this. I don't think that that's a bad way to use it as a recruiting tool, and I've been in that camp for a while. I think guaranteeing it to a kid to get him on campus, so many things can happen. The last thing you want to do is sell the number or potentially put undue stress on a kid either.
Yeah, I can see it both ways. I mean, if there's a kid that's like an absolute can't miss, I'm okay with it because that's how it's been used in the past and that's how it was used going from Brown to Davis to Little. But at the same time, like, you would hope that, like, I don't think the number is so powerful that a kid's going to change his entire destination based on it. Maybe it's like a cool, like, cherry on top, or, you know, it's like the final thing. But overall, like, you're going to have to sell it to the school first, and if 44 becomes a thing that you can throw in there afterwards, you know, then we come to that bridge. But I think you have to lay a lot of groundwork before that's like a game-changing decision on both sides.
No, I completely agree. I think that, you know, that's what I'm finding. Maybe people are finding the middle ground more this time around. I think a year ago, around this time we were talking about it, I feel like people were very much, you're either on one side or the other. And I feel like now, you know, I feel like some things have changed in the athletic program. I feel like our attitudes have changed. We realize that, you know, and this isn't to start up this debate again, but, you know, Scott Schaefer was a very much like hard line, it's one thing or the other type of guy. And I feel like that started spurring similar behaviors among the fan base. And I feel like we've moved past that. I mean, Babers is still very much it's either this or that type guy, but not in a way that galvanizes people toward getting angry at each other. If that makes any sense, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's also hasn't been around as much as long, so he, you know, comes in with his own preconceptions, and clearly there have been way bigger things to worry about. Obviously, there was an AD change, and now there's another AD change, and he's just trying to learn about Syracuse itself. So before you start like making some grand decisions about traditions, like the Schaefer thing didn't become a huge story until Schaefer's seventh year on campus. This is obviously Babers, you know, we're what, in 5 months on? So, you know, maybe down the road it'll be something that we revisit more once he decides how he wants to use it as a recruiting tool, or as an award, or like a captain, or like a super captaincy, or like however he wants to do it. But it's understandable. I think no matter what he ends up deciding, I think his statements yesterday, like, I think they hold up. Like, you don't want a person who is going to only be coming here for that one reason. Otherwise, you know, it just doesn't seem like it's going to work out.
Completely agree. So I guess pivoting a little bit based on what you were saying before, you know, talking about the AD change, Sean and I obviously went into a lot of detail about, you know, the aftermath right away. But now looking forward, Dan, do you have any kind of clubhouse favorite in terms of who you want or who you think it could be? Or do you think that this is still, you know, something very much in the air and you're just going to kind of let it ride out? You're not even going to bother, you know, hedging your bets?
It's tough. It's funny. A lot of people have said it's the second time we've gone through this process in a year. And at the same time, the job is like totally, it's such a different job now because of football being changed. So you have to bring in someone who is willing to work with Babers as if it's their hire. I think that's the only fair way to do it because Dino hasn't done anything that he hasn't put anything, any like numbers down or anything that you can use as a determining factor, whether, you know, things are going well or not. So I think you have to come in someone that'll give him a complete, like I said, someone who acts as if he's the person who hired Babers and judges him from there. And obviously, I don't know if the Hopkins thing is like now, if there's any room to change on that. I honestly don't think there should be at this point. It's been so long with him. But like all these big decisions were made in a very short amount of time for Coyle, like, and pretty, you know, fairly early. And then, you know, it didn't seem like a lot was happening from there. Obviously, you guys went into last week, like, he made the hire. There was the Hopkins thing, like, really early on in his tenure. And then we kind of just waited for, you know, games to be scheduled or all these little things that ADs do, and that didn't really happen. It's just not, like, the same exact type of thing. And I think if we get another guy who profiles just like Coyle, I think that's fine. I don't think you freak out because one guy left after 10 months when that's really not the norm with ADs. And at the same time, if you want to go down the line of people who are familiar with Syracuse, I think that's fine. I just don't think that can be your only factor because that, like, you're limiting yourself so much.
Yeah, I concur there. I think it was one thing when I was hearing it from fans. I thought that it was just, you know, typical fan bubble talk now. And even when I saw it like creep into the media a little bit, because, you know, Syracuse is a smaller market. You can pander a little bit. You should and kind of need to at times. We've seen what happens when you don't. But I think that now that you're hearing Boeheim talk about it, now that it's gaining more traction, I would hope that Syracuse and its at times bubble philosophy about the world doesn't make us sell ourselves short. I think that the only drawback to the job right now is the fact that, you know, any AD is going to have to wait at least 3 years before making a football or basketball hire. That, to me, might be an inhibitor for a guy like Coyle, who's a little bit younger and still wants to, you know, put his own, you know, stake down. But for maybe somebody who's a little bit older and wants to kind of ride it out into the sunset and has already done a nice job, maybe this is an ideal situation.
Right. It's like you just need to get a different, there's a different set of circumstances as to who's going to take it. Like you said, Coyle obviously wanted to make his mark. He did. And he took over a job where that was going to be a possibility. And it's interesting because he actually takes over another job where obviously Tracy Clays had his interim tag removed, but he's also a guy that you have to feel like is going to be on a much shorter leash than he might have been had the circumstances at Minnesota not changed. I just think people are freaking out because we had this happen after 10 months. Realistically, we all know why Coyle left. He left because he got a giant pay raise. He's now, if I'm correct, the most highly paid AD in the Big Ten, right? Which is pretty crazy.
Fourth. Behind the usual giants, I think Ohio State, Michigan for sure, and probably Penn State, if I had to guess.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, he's up there. And how many... obviously, you know, Big Ten has its own things. They're huge schools. They have the big contract, but how many other schools are going to be able to make a Trump offer like that to our next AD? ADs don't move that as much as coaches. So, you know, maybe there are like 20 schools and those jobs open, you know, maybe you have two or three of those jobs open every year.
And a bunch of them opened recently.
Right, so the numbers just don't work out to where like Syracuse is going to be targeted to, you know, have their AD poached every 3 years. Like, it's just not realistic, so... This thing, it happened to work out the way it did, and I kind of get, like, why people are freaking out and thinking you'd have to go get a Syracuse lifer or a Syracuse alum, And like I said, I'd be all fine with a Syracuse alum as long as they're like totally qualified otherwise. And, you know, it just works out that way. But to make that like the first thing you look for is the wrong way to go about it, I think.
Yeah, it narrows the pool. Why not look for the most qualified guy? And then if they're a Syracuse alum, it's a bonus. You know, we saw, like, what happened the last time we went out to get a Syracuse guy? Like, he left after 4 years to go coach the Buffalo Bills. And he'd and he would have rather done that. And now would rather, you know, coach the line in Jacksonville than live anywhere near Central New York again. Like, to me, this just seems like we've done this before and Marone was a good idea. But if you're bringing somebody in with Syracuse ties because you want him to stay, like, you would hope that any alum has the wherewithal and has the pedigree and success that other schools would want him or her, in this case, if you're an AD. Like, I don't understand why we're using such a constrained filter when Syracuse prides itself on having upwardly mobile, upwardly moving, and successful people, you know, go through its doors. So why do we want to hire somebody who has no desire to do that?
Exactly. And, you know, it's a whole different discussion if Coyle leaves after 5 years, which is still a pretty quick tenure for an AD. But I don't think people would have the same reaction to the way they did. It just, the timing was very peculiar. He obviously had a connection to Minnesota. Yeah, I don't think it was quite the, I mean, who am I to say, but it doesn't seem like it was really the place his family loved the most after their, you know, 18 stops in the last 30 years or whatever. But that's not a real number, but he's been around. But, you know, it was just a high paying job there. He was probably more comfortable than Syracuse, and it just happened to come up. And it wasn't even like a natural thing where their AD moved on. They had like a whole scandal and everything. So just worked out in kind of a crazy way. I don't think that should affect our processes, where I think we've all been pretty impressed with how Siverud has handled big things like this. So I would hope that he would like continue going on the path he's gone rather than change like everything he's done to this point to, you know, make these pyres and these decisions.
Oh, agreed. I mean, I think we're all noted Kent fans. I think he's done things in a much more efficient and better way than Nancy Kanter. I think he's made hires better. I think he's conducted business better in the fact that he stays out of the news except when he needs to be. He makes strong statements and walks away. Like, he does a lot right, and I think why people were really puzzled was because, like, Kent had his fingerprints all over the Coyle hire because Coyle resembled him in a lot of ways. And it's interesting that Kent would go that direction with somebody that there was even an inkling that they could leave, which makes me think that, you know, perhaps there wasn't an inkling at all. And I think I buy into what we're hearing around campus that, you know, there was no inkling. And it also just goes to show how unpredictable these things can be. Like, you just never know when somebody finds, you know, I hate the term dream job, but yeah, finds that dream job and finds the place that they want to land for 10, 15 years instead of where you are. And these things, timing-wise, I mean, based on what we've heard, it seems like Minnesota, the timing of everything that happened last summer was really just, you know, immediately after Coyle took the reins at Syracuse, and perhaps things shake out differently if you know, those time frames work out just slightly off. Perhaps he just goes right to Minnesota instead of Syracuse, but we'll never know, you know, unless perhaps some requests into the University of Minnesota for commentary show us otherwise.
Yes, and this is why Georgia will never find out why people come or go from Georgia, because their requests will be buried for like 3 years.
Very true. Looking at something else that Chance of Siverud and of course the new AD are going to have their fingerprints on, whether or not they were, you know, crucially involved or not, is the Carrier Dome. Or as the university is now just calling it, the Dome, based on the release that was kind of pushed out with little fanfare at first on Monday. And that is, you know, a $250 million spend, on a new roof, other improvements, especially around, they're attaching themselves to the American Disabilities Act, but I think it's clear that this is not just limited to that scope, but it's really going to be kind of expanded into everything that we want to see changed and adjusted and altered in the dome, or at least we hope that's the case. I think for $250 million, you are hoping for at least some larger scale items to be addressed, no, Dan?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the roof is huge in and of itself. Not only for just the fact that you don't have to replace it every 20 years, you get like a, I think they said 50 years is the general lifespan. But aesthetically, the EFTE material that they're planning on using, which is being used in the new Viking Stadium, like it's really good looking. It lets light in. I'm assuming there are ways to like change how reflective it is and how much light comes through for basketball, because otherwise we have kind of a very interesting situation. Or like you block that area or whatever. But it's a good looking thing. I know there Pete Salas said there were plans to somehow have it so you could almost see into the building from the quad, so it's like a little less closed off. I don't know if that has to do with like taking off one of the concrete sides or whatever, but it definitely seems like they've kind of tapped into a lot of the different things people have talked about for years now. And obviously the big debate up to this point had been, you know, new stadium or renovate the dome. And if you do new stadium, do you do it where the dome is? Honestly, I'm kind of happy with the direction they're going, just because obviously the dome's not perfect. Like the parking situation is not great, which leads to, you know, the tailgating situation not being great, and a lot of other things, but it's fairly centrally located. Like it's easy for students to get there, which, you know, you move it elsewhere and you really see student issues, which are already not great. I just think like the dome obviously has its issues, but it being on campus is really cool, and there's a lot of advantages to that. And I would have been kind of disappointed to see those taken away, especially when like the other proposals, like putting it by the other like ideas people have thrown around, putting it by the fairgrounds. Like what? I get like that might be easier for some people, but if we're like coming back to campus as alumni, I don't think any of us are going to want to hike over there for games. Obviously, it's not just about alumni, but you try to strike a balance. And I think keeping it in the dome location and renovating the existing dome, and it seems like it's going to be like a real like big renovation where it's going to be almost feel like a completely new facility. I think that's all good. So I'm excited to see when the actual plans come out. Hopefully they're as impressive as we hope they are.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like Syracuse is using the best in the business in terms of firms. You know, Populous, the architectural design firm, is one of the best around. Turner, they were celebrating as the firm that handled the Madison Square Garden.
MSG.
Yeah,
which looks amazing.
Yeah, and I mean,
if you've been to MSG recently,
yeah, Madison Square Garden looks great. I haven't been recently, unfortunately, but I've seen enough games from the Rangers and the Knicks to know that it looks great. I think that we have some different challenges, and we also have some better ones. I know I addressed this in the article the other day about, not missing, trying not to miss, Syracuse football and basketball games. People seem to think this is probably going to be a several-year process. I don't know enough about architecture to know if that's the case. I would assume the roof is probably a long-term deal and one that really needs to be done right. I think the roof might be step one, and then these other elements might have to be step two. But again, this is conjecture. The university hasn't given us any sort of timeline, so it's hard to say. In any case, I think that the main issue, roof number one, widening concourses probably number two, and then changing the fundamental aspects of the building enough that you can get out of the carrier dome deal is number three. Maybe you want to move that up to two. I'm not sure. In any case, I don't think comfortable seats is high on the list. But if you are a Syracuse fan who voted in a certain Syracuse.com poll yesterday, maybe you feel differently. It seems like you feel differently, which to me, whatever. I think Dan and myself and Mike McAllister and others poured enough e-ink into the jokes about raking leaves and apple picking for decades.
Yeah, my heart sank into my stomach when I saw that poll. And I felt no, I had no compunction to like not put that on Twitter because, and I, let me tell you, like, I've never had so many Clemson fans come into my Twitter feed, and I don't think they even knew I was a Syracuse fan. I think they thought I was just some random person making fun of Syracuse, and we deserved every bit of it because holy shit, come on. Like, really? It wasn't even close. It was like four, and I looked like hours later to see if it was just maybe a small sample when I looked at it. It was still like 42%. Thought the seats were the biggest deal and not the football team.
Okay.
Like, every how many other Notre Dame has bleachers. Michigan has bleachers. I believe Ohio State has bleachers.
Clemson
like,
has bleachers.
Clemson has bleachers. Like, all these big-time programs, most of them have bleachers because they try to pack as many people in there as they can because they're competing for attendance records and whatnot. Seats are nice. Like, if you can do that, I'm fine with it. I don't think it would be the end of the world if we bumped the capacity down from like 49 to 44 or whatever.
44444 is the number you're looking for.
That's what it should be. We should do anything we can to get to that. I think that's fine if that's a thing you want to do, but no, that's not the biggest deal. And some one person's like, yeah, but that's not a thing you change at the dome. I'm like, yeah, but it's still on the poll. Like, the poll was different, gave you these options, and one of the options was, hey, let's get a good football team. That should have been 99.9% of the votes.
Well, especially so, from the people that, I mean, and to
complain about it so
complain about
much.
The team being bad and saying, be good, and we'll show up again. Like, okay, well, it ends up that what you really want is for the seats of the dome to mimic your couch, which you're usually sitting on, not watching the game. Or even if you are, like, you're probably within, like, 10 miles of the stadium. It just, there are so many things to unpack there, and I'm not even going to bother with them here because I'm just going to go into one of those, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier about local media and pandering. We get in trouble when we don't pander. I'm not going to pander, but I'm also not going to go down this dark road of putting people on blast. I think that there's a big benefit towards more comfortable seats and a big benefit toward a slightly smaller stadium that maybe provides more of a premium in-game experience. But I hope people understand that with all that, those premiums that they want and could potentially get here will come with higher prices on these seats.
And God forbid you pay more than $99 for your season ticket.
Christ. That's a whole nother, again, conversation around if you people can't get there at $99, when will you? Because I usually pay close to that for some of the road games that I end up going to for Syracuse for one ticket.
I may buy a season ticket just to do it, and I maybe go to two games up at the Dome, and, like, I'm happy. If I get two games out of my $99 and maybe I can sell the rest on StubHub for, like, $10 each, I'd be thrilled with that. And that's probably, like, way over, like, that's probably way more than I could get for them on the open market. But, like, come on. Like, if you're going to like a decent concert at MSG, you're not getting a decent seat for $99 for one thing, one event.
Yeah.
And here we're going to have hopefully a, you know, if not great right away, a more fun football team than we've had in a while, and the price point has not moved up in 7 or 8 years. Yeah. So if it moves up, if we have to pay $120 for season tickets after the dome renovation, or $150, if people complain, I am going to lose my mind.
Oh, but they will.
Oh, I know they will. I'm preparing everyone. Like, we'll have in 2 or 3 years on this podcast, we were going to throw like a tantrum about it. So prepare yourselves.
I would have to agree there. On that note, Dan, what have you been drinking? I know you weren't on the podcast last week, so you have 2 weeks of drinking to recap.
Yeah, I actually had a couple interesting things here because it's been a while. And thanks again to Sean and Jim for filling in on the double podcast last week.
Bonus everyone.
Yes. And thank you for Mark Coyle for making that happen. So right after last time I was on, we spent a good portion of our time talking about the San Diego Toreros.
Toreros.
The nation crossing PFL Toreros. And after that, and we talked about how neither of us were having a fun Cinco de Mayo, I ended up actually going out after that, which I did not plan on, and had a Sol Style from Green Flash, a San Diego brewery, which we've talked about before. Sol Style IPA, which is really good, like super floral, nice hoppiness, but like, you know, a lot going on there. I really enjoyed it. I had a briny melon Joseph from Anderson Valley.
which it's supposed to be like a watermelon beer. I'm actually kind of glad it's not that watermelon-y because I've had watermelon beers before, and like sometimes they're just like way too much. This was like a very, very sour dose, but it wasn't like overly watermelon-y, just like enough. So I thought that was nice and refreshing. Let me see. Some other things I haven't had talked about before. I had a hop hash from Sweetwater Brewing down in Georgia, if I'm correct, which was super, 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 like, I mean, it's called hop hash. You can imagine, like, that really, like, dank hoppy flavor. Quite good. Let's see. I had Oarsman Ale from Bell's, which I really liked. That was a little more, I'm trying to remember what that was like. I enjoyed it. I didn't take any notes on it, which is my fault. But Bell's made good stuff. So, and that was one of them. And then the other night I had, a couple really interesting ones. I had, the Freshy Salt and Pepper from Nomad Brewing, which is Australian, and it's actually brewed with seawater. And you can tell, like, it's not like obnoxiously salty, but it's definitely like a salty flavor plus like kind of a citrusy wheat thing going on, which makes for like a really nice, like, sweet and salty blend. It's really interesting. I haven't had anything like this before. So that was something. And then I had from OEC Brewing Connecticut, the their Artista Zinergia Odulis, which is an obnoxious name to try to pronounce, which is basically like a pretty good wheat beer.
And there you go. Dan, the one week that you would normally have more than me, I had to go to a brewery anniversary party. So
actually, I didn't check in, but I had something from the brewery this week too, and I can't remember what it was, and I forgot to check into it.
Well, maybe I can jog your memory. I'm not sure. I had quite a bit because the brewery anniversary party was unlimited tasters, which is always a great idea, and I wish more breweries would do it. Anyway, so. Things that I had there. I'm not going to do everything. I'm just going to do some of the things because there were a lot. I drank like 30 different beers while I was there. Had Sour in the Rye with nectarines. Sour in the Rye is one of the brewery's staple sours and one of their best annual releases. The nectarine version was equally excellent. Additionally, they had... Sorry, my... Oh. Had a... Cordial BBLs. It was a blend of Black Tuesday, Tarted Darkness, and So Happens It's Tuesday, with cocoa nibs, cherries, and vanilla. That was pretty excellent. Luckily, they kept those to 1.5-ounce pours. That way, you weren't going to die, because that one's probably hanging around 18-19% alcohol. They had a bunch of these that were just like kind of one-off for the event. Another one was Sherbert Hoover. It was a sour blonde ale with blood oranges, vanilla, and lactose. And obviously, people who were involved at all in political science in college, like Dan and myself, can laugh about that one and the Herbert Hoover pun that goes into it. We have Keen Observation from the Rare Barrel, and they're sour from them. Have Saison 100 from Highland Park Brewing. I had Firestone released one of their Saisons as like kind of an hourly release. It was a La Piccola Pepe de Sijuan. It was a just a Saison. Had Windowsill from the brewery. It was a kind of raspberry and rhubarb. I forgot. I think it's just a sour. Had Port Barrel Aged Black Tuesday, which was pretty phenomenal on all fronts. Had Abnormal Beers Year One Double IPA. Abnormal just showed up down in San Diego recently, and they've become one of the more standout new breweries in the last year to year and a half. Had a Double Barrel Black Tuesday, so aged in barrels and then aged in barrels again, which is pretty excellent. Had a bunch of other things I don't remember the exact description of, but the brewery's Beauregard, Befuddlement, computer's lagging a bit. Oh, I had Vic's Secret Showers from Noble Ale Works. It was their latest double IPA. It was excellent. It was actually going to be on at this IPA fest here in Redondo Beach, so and I'm going to try to drink that again this weekend if I can. I checked out a taster of Let It Linger. It was a sour blonde ale with cranberries and oranges. That one's also from the brewery. Had a Libertines Pepe Le Pluot. It was a sour ale. Again, if my computer was agreeing with me, we would be done with this already. Oh, and then I had Fuzzy BBLs. It was probably one of my favorite other ones that I drank. That one was similar to the cordial one. It was a blend of Black Tuesday, Tired Darkness, and So Happens It's Tuesday, with peaches, apricots, vanilla, and lactose. So we'll close on that.
I like that you listed too many beers for your computer to handle.
Yeah, well, for some reason, I mean, it's mostly because SB Nation's now going with, like, more rich media ads. So I usually have the Noon's homepage up when I'm doing this, and because of all these, like, wacky ads that keep popping up, it's now decided that, like, my computer's decided it goes into overdrive every time I try this. Like, open a webpage, which is awesome.
It is awesome, because people are getting paid.
People are getting paid
on the internet.
Yeah, people are getting paid on the internet, which is the positive here. I don't want to hate, but on the negative side, it becomes much, much harder to open web pages.
I think what it's telling you is that the only web page you should have open is Troy Noon's is an absolute magician.
Obviously, and not even Skype, because why would you want to have Skype open if you were on a podcast on Skype? Anyway, so Dan, another thing that's kind of come up this week, and at least I kind of brought it to the forefront, the Big Ten ESPN contract negotiations are going on, and I'm not sure it's going to happen for them, which has a lot of things that could potentially spill over for the ACC and Syracuse, obviously. Dan, what's your gut feeling? I know all of us people that write about sports on the internet, especially college sports, have turned into, TV market and revenue experts. So what's your gut feeling here?
I don't know. It's tough because on one side, like, you think that the Big Ten doing all the way with just Fox, or I don't know how else they would do this, would just not seem to be feasible, just because, A, Fox has other properties already. They have Pac-12 stuff. They have Big 12 stuff. I know the Big Ten, they're partnered with for the network and everything, and I'm sure they'd have the channels to make it work, but it just seems like you'd be putting all your fish in one barrel. For Syracuse, I think it'd be kind of cool because it probably means fewer games stuck on, like, RSN and the ACC, whatever regional networks. So that'd be great because ESPN would have more time slots to fill, and they have the whole ACC, they have all ACC everything, basically.
But more noon games, probably, as a result.
Yeah, you probably have more noon games, that's true. Overall, it's interesting just because, like, it seems like both sides were kind of just holding serve and waiting for the other one to just be like, okay, let's just figure this out. But, I mean, it also seems like ESPN's just not willing, like, they have kind of seen where the market's gone with these live events, and I know that's, like, the one thing people think you can sell. It almost leads back into that column Stuart Mandel did this week where he had, like, the 2014, like, Super Conference, and while that, I think, is maybe, like, a little unrealistic for that to be a decade from now, the major point behind it is he said that, you know, instead of looking for as many games as you can just get on TV, the big thing people are going to focus on going forward are, like, the bigger games and trying to, like, the most people watching, like, one or two big games every weekend. And in that case, like, maybe it does make sense for the ESPN to just, like, focus in, like, hardcore on just getting the best ACC and SEC games, and maybe we but either way, like, it seems like it'd be a pretty big stretch to just see the Big Ten just move itself all the way onto Fox if that's how it ends up. I don't know if, like, NBC or CBS would get involved or whatever, but
you have to. I mean, NBC did just grab Tirico. I know, like, I bounced it around on our Slack room and some other places. Like, that to me seems like the one that makes sense. I mean, NBC has you know, Sunday Night Football, and they had the Premier League, and then they have hockey as like their biggest properties. But other than that, and the Olympics every 2 years, NBC doesn't have a lot of like weekly standby programming. Again, also slighting Notre Dame here, so I guess they do have more than I thought. But nonetheless, you're still looking at, I think, less properties on NBC on a weekly basis than maybe, you know, Fox and ESPN. I know Matt Brown over at Land Grant Holy Land also floated out, you know, some additional options, something like a Turner setup, perhaps CBS getting a little more involved beyond just the SEC. There are some things out there that could develop into, you know, a competitive offer. And if ESPN's going to lowball, maybe because they think that if the Big Ten thinks that Fox paid fair market value, then anything below that is going to be a lowball to them. I don't think ESPN buys into that value, but that's where, you know, I got into this in the article, that's where competitors show up and outbid and overpay for these things. I think where ESPN is maybe looking is that they don't want to be seen as, or even see for themselves and for their shareholders as a company that's overpaying for all these rights. And you brought up a good point there on Mandel's model, and that was, you know, get the highest inventory, not of total games, but of quality games. Where I really see this kind of trending, and you already saw it with the NBA this year, is sort of a little bit with the pay-per-play model. NBA on top of season ticket and their, you know, team-specific pass that was like 100 to 120, and it included streaming and everything else. They also had your pay-per-game model where, and I'd love to see if the NBA actually releases the data on that at the end of the year, is which teams had the most paid games if you were going, you know, just a per-game model, I'm going to pay for just this. You know, which games were the most bought, you know, in a pay-per-view model. I think that there's a lot of interesting data that's going to come out of that, and it's something that could potentially shape the ESPN's model, and ESPN's model specifically with the ACC.
Right. The NBC thing is interesting. Would you be worried about and the Big Ten and Notre Dame having the same broadcast partner?
Maybe, but at the same time, like, I don't think Notre Dame cares where it's on national television every weekend, as long as it is. I think that NBC's been a long-term partner that's helped it. I think that there's a concern about ESPN. I mean, you saw a ratings drop at the playoff this year, and there's always that concern with cord cutting and cable, and you know you don't have the same older segment of the population that only has basic channels, but you do have a lot of people that don't have cable, and that becomes an issue for putting your premier product on cable, and maybe that's something that weighs you know, Notre Dame's decision when their TV rights come up, and that is a concern. I don't know if I necessarily care, however, you know, if Notre Dame and the Big Ten have rights in the same place.
Yep. I do think the Mandel thing, like, obviously it's super, I don't think it's that out there in terms of like the line of thinking. I just think the time frame is probably a little unrealistic, just as none of these things have moved that quickly. But overall, I think he raised some really good points, so people should go check that out. And obviously that leaves a lot of questions of, as a Syracuse fan, being left out isn't great. I don't love that, but when you're being left out, so is like Ole Miss and South Carolina and like two-thirds of the existing power structure, I guess.
I'm more fine with that. I'd love...
Yeah, you learn how to cope.
I'd love the... like, that's the only place that I think there's a chance for the promotion relegation model to work.
The problem is, like, you'd have to... The promotion relegation thing would work if you had, like, 18 teams that aren't going to move, and then you just, like, they say, hey, let's leave these spots open for the rest. But if you have 24 teams that are all equal partners, like, no one's going to... They're not going to do it. Like, it just... No one's going to want to risk... Like Texas. There's no way Texas would be, like, cool with getting relegated, and they would have been relegated both these years. Easy. So...
Would they, though, in that group? I mean, I guess it depends on how you do it. Like, I recommended in the comments for our own article that Melissa put together, it was If you grouped everybody regionally in both tier one and two, and I think you stopped the promotion or relegation there, I think you just had the two tiers. Then in that case, you group everybody by division. So you just have you have four divisions of six, and then the top team from tier two in the corresponding division moves up. The bottom team moves down. I mean, some years that's going to be rough, but if you're facing a lot, if you're pretty much facing just people in yours, I think the frauds are going to expose themselves very quickly, but I don't think that Texas necessarily moves as quickly as we think in that group either.
I just mean like how Texas has been the last 2 years.
Right. Well, I mean, like if you're going to put Arkansas and some other teams in there, I think that Texas sticks around more easily than we think.
Mandel had Texas in the West with UCLA, USC, Stanford, Oregon, Oklahoma. Obviously, they beat Oklahoma, but that was crazy. Oregon depends, you know, maybe they sneaked that out if they had played Oregon when Adams was hurt. UCLA, USC weren't great. Stanford probably would have wrecked them. And then if you have, like, the crossover, I guess, like, the easiest crossover division would have been, I mean, none of these are super easy. Maybe the East. Clemson would beat them. Florida, who knows? Florida State would have beat them. Georgia probably would have beat them. Miami, who knows? Penn State, who knows? So, like, that's probably the easiest path Texas would have gotten, and I don't see them getting more than, like, four wins out of that. So then in that hypothetical situation where Texas is, like, 2015 Texas and the bottom, I don't know how many you'd relegate, four teams, one from each division maybe, get sent down, like, was Texas cool with that? Like, I don't know that they would be, but I... You know, maybe it's just structured differently. Yeah. Promotion validation would be really cool. I'd be with that, and then you always have something to play for. Where, you know, if Syracuse just gets relegated to, you know, second tier status, and it's still a mid second tier with like most of the schools that are big time schools,
and it's rivals by and large.
Yeah,
Pitt and BC then, are there like, and others.
Yeah, I always like the idea of Syracuse being able to play for a national championship in football, even if it's like way out there. Like, I like the idea that if everything broke right, they could do it. And maybe then you change the playoff structure to where it's the top four from each of these division, or one from each division, and then the top two via some, you know, chicanery, however they do it normally, you know, votes or polls or whatever. But I think you'd have to have some kind of pathway for teams to either compete for a national title every year, even if it's not a direct path, or to like work their way into it. Otherwise, like you're just changing, like you're basically adding like a new version of FBS on top of what we already have.
Right. And to be honest, yeah, I don't buy it ever being implemented. I think ProRel is always just a fun thing to toss around. I think the U.S. is too big for it. And I've said this before to people, the reason college football is the best sport in a lot of people's eyes, and the reason that I love it and you love it and others do, is because, yeah, that specter of anyone can win is always out there, and that doesn't really hold true for any other sport, a college or pro. I think, you know, there's always exceptions. Obviously, you have something like the Premier League, Leicester City winning bucks that trend, but I don't think it's something you can bank on every year. I think for college football, the best part is that every game really does matter, and every game, you know, at the end of the day, like for some teams, you know, the quote unquote championship for them is winning six because they haven't done it in a while. They just want to get back to a bowl. For others, yeah, the championship is actually winning it all. For others, it's, you know, we want to get to the Rose Bowl, whatever it is. And I think that all those individual championships are something that no other sport has. And I think it's something that keeps every week interesting, keeps every fan base interested, at least until they're eliminated from the postseason.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of share that with the Premier League in terms of, like, obviously Leicester made that crazy jump and went from, like, you know, people thought maybe they'd get relegated this year if things didn't go well, to winning the whole thing. But overall, like, generally teams have different goals, whether it's, like you said, winning the entire league or making the top four or avoiding relegation if you're not good. And it makes, like, almost, you know, the most of the table has something to play for unless you're stuck in that, like, weird, like 12 to 14 range. But and college football has similar things. Like you said, you have obviously the rivalries are always important, just getting to like different tiers of bowls and working your way up that way, or obviously recruiting adds a whole nother like meta game into the whole thing. But if you had like cut the wheat from the chaff and put these 24 teams in their own thing and everyone else is just playing for best of the rest, I think you lose a lot. So hopefully, you know, I do think we'll see some radical over time, I think you know, college football look way different in 30 years than it does now. But hopefully it's something that's still, like, relatively inclusive. And I know that's being kind of hypocritical because, like, Syracuse is right now a quote, have team compared to, like, a Colorado State or whoever who really doesn't have a huge pathway to winning the whole thing. But at least, like, there's still that dream where if everything broke right, they could do it.
No, I completely agree there. So I guess closing out a little bit, Syracuse, well, both Syracuse lacrosse teams are in the postseason right now. I think that the Syracuse women stand a great chance of beating USC, but focusing in on the men a little bit more, if only because that game is going to be a lot more pressure-packed and a lot more... I think that Syracuse is not favored in this one, and that's obviously going to add a little bit to the intrigue. Versus USC, where I think that Syracuse is going to be favored against them in the women's bracket. Dan, do you think Syracuse stands a chance against Maryland?
Yeah, I mean, Maryland's really good. They've been one of the more consistent teams. Obviously, they survived this weekend when lacrosse went crazy this weekend with Denver losing and Yale losing.
So much fun,
and, you know. Yeah, like it was like the college basketball tournament in lacrosse, which was great because like usually we maybe see one of those. This year there were like three or four. And Maryland obviously got by. They beat Quinnipiac without too much of an issue. So yeah, I mean it's still Syracuse lacrosse. Obviously they're going to. I don't know. I don't think anyone on this team would even have been on the 2011, right? Like I can't imagine anyone's still around.
Yeah, unless somebody was No, yeah, I guess you're right. I don't think anybody could be around at this point, even with a red shirt.
Yeah, unless there was like a weird six-year situation, I think we'd know about that. But I was at that game. It was as bad as everyone said. As soon as we got that Maryland draw after beating Albany, really just awful. I'm glad it helped lead to the shot clock. Like directly, I think the shot clock came in the next year, or it got past the next year after that, and then came in the year after. But hopefully Destro's been, you know, showed that game film, been like, yo, this is what Maryland did last time. This was ridiculous. Let's go get it. I mean, we're definitely not like a huge, you know, I don't think there's a huge talent gap. Syracuse won six in a row. They obviously Albany was really nice. Come from behind winning. It's a really good team. So, there's definitely a chance. I obviously they're not favored or anything, but, I'm excited to see because the team does seem to be hitting its stride at the right, perfect time and playing. I don't know if you still call them a rival now that you know we're in different conferences, but another one of the more blue bloodish teams in the country is always fun.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely say that. I think Maryland falls into tier two of blue bloods at this point. I don't think that's really, you know, anything to be ashamed of. I think the blue blood group is actually even in flux a little bit of late. I think we're obviously still in it. I think Hopkins.
I think you keep them in there. Like they're such a big name. It's like UCLA is still a blue blood in basketball, and they haven't done anything in a while. So I think it's hard to lose. I think it's hard to fall out of it. I think it's way harder to get in there than it is to fall out.
Yeah, I buy that. So yeah, I think Maryland's there. I think that our rivalry with Maryland in lacrosse kind of transcends conference lines, if only because we only shared a conference with them for a very short period. I think that any of the teams at the top of lacrosse in particular, they don't necessarily need conferences to be rivals just because of the nature of the tournament and the nature of non-conference scheduling. I think that we've all faced each other quite a bit. I think this is going to be a fun game. I think that both fan bases are pretty pumped for it. I know for Syracuse, I think for both teams that there's a lot. I think you're seeing a lot more pressure maybe in this game than any of the other ones just because these are two fan bases that desperately need to get back to the Final Four to feel okay with their place in the world. While I feel like the other games, you know, for Brown, it's a surprise, but it's a nice one. For Navy, it's a culmination of a rebuilding project. Over the Notre Dame, North Carolina, I think Notre Dame, they've shown that they're in there And I mean, maybe not they're not a blue blood necessarily, but they've shown that they can fight at that weight. I think Carolina is 20 years removed from their last trip to the Final Four. That's a vindication, but I still think the pressure and that, you know, Loyola, Towson, I think both of them are just kind of, hey, it's great that we got here. I think for Maryland and Syracuse, there's just so much more stress and pressure attached to it than there might be elsewhere.
Yeah, it's one of the interesting things that comes with like the upsets is they're really grouped like kind of interestingly, because you have Maryland, Syracuse, and then you have Notre Dame, North Carolina. Obviously, Notre Dame has been one of the better programs in the country for the last, you know, 5-6 years. North Carolina is one of the bigger names in the country, but they, you know, like you said, have won in a long time, even longer than Syracuse, despite what the Fire Desto group will tell you. It's only been less than a decade. So you have that across the top, and then the bottom, it's just like, it's like straight up bracket busters. Like, Brown's been awesome this year, so it's not like they're, you know, the way they beat Hopkins, I think, is a little shocking. Throwing 17 up on the board, it's, you know, pretty crazy. But Navy obviously spurned the big upset, and then Loyola obviously won a title a couple years ago, but they're still, you know, they're Loyola. They're a good story, but they're not quite, you know, Syracuse, Maryland, or Notre Dame. And then Towson, another just like awesome upset. But really interesting how the bracket broke out, like in those two distinct top and bottom halves.
Yeah, and you know, once again, it's going to be the ACC. You know, has its haters in college lacrosse just because it's such a consolidation of power. But you know, you look at how this laid out. I mean, Syracuse could have potentially had three or four, you know, in this thing. Even as you know, even from this round, if you just slotted North Carolina somewhere else, and you could have easily done so. So I guess looking at just the matchup, Maryland plays a much different style than Syracuse. I think that Maryland and Stalling have distanced themselves from each other a little bit. Dan, do you feel like Syracuse has the firepower to hang with Maryland, since they seem like they can definitely score more than maybe some previous years?
Yeah, I mean, it'll take like a really great game from our guys, obviously. If they play the whole game like they did in the second half, and you have Ben Williams start getting on a roll, obviously he had a very strange first half against Albany where he couldn't seem to get a faceoff at all. And then he came to, and you know, faceoffs only mean so much, but it's nice. I'd rather have them than not. Yeah, I mean, I think it'll take closer to like an A game for Syracuse to really threaten here, but I don't think the gap is probably as big as you'd think between an 8 seed and a 1 seed, just because, you know, Syracuse was probably a little underseeded, and it's still Syracuse. They're still always going to be one of probably the three or four most talented teams in the country. So I think Maryland's a very fair favorite, but I'm looking forward to it, because it just, you know, should be a really nice game, and you can't get, I don't think, too crazily upset if they do lose it, which often is the case in March, or not March, May.
Well, no, March too, to be honest. If you, I think.
I mean, yeah, still applies.
Yeah, I think that the one thing you can count on with Syracuse fans is that once we're in the postseason, whatever previous notions of what we were going to do are gone, and the only goal and acceptable outcome is winning a championship. Although, at the same time, I would say that's not the case in April, where Syracuse was about as chill as you could possibly be, coming off a loss to North Carolina in the Final Four. I can't really say I saw many tears or sadness or anger or anything like that. There are a couple people despondent, my buddy Scott included, but by and large, even myself, who would not pass off as the most rational Syracuse fan around, I was pretty zen, not gonna lie. I was at ease with it well before it happened, and well after it ended.
Just straight gravy to the veins this April. we didn't want to admit it, but we had a bad gravy problem.
Honestly, if I had better reception in NRG Stadium, I definitely would have tweeted my traditional Crowther's drinking gravy image just for the hell of it.
Never try to do anything with the Wi-Fi inside of a Final Four event, as I learned in 2013.
Yeah, although 2014, it wasn't bad. I at Lucas Oil, I actually had pretty good reception for most of the time. the fact that I was, although I will say too, like by, I think it was much better during the championship game. I was actually able to tweet like utter nonsense after the final shot from Villanova, which I couldn't do anything for much of the both semifinal games on that Saturday.
Yeah, that's what happens when you lose Syracuse fans. We obviously were gobbling up all of the internets.
All right, I think that'll do it for us. Dan, always appreciate you hanging out and talking about Syracuse. We actually managed to do it for most of the time this year.
Yeah, no, we actually had things to talk about, which is just crazy confluence of events this week. I don't think it probably won't be as on point. We'll get into those Tulane jerseys next week, everyone. So you can tune in. Don't be mad at us that we didn't talk about it.
Wait with bated breath. Yeah, thanks everybody for tuning in, and thanks Dan for hanging out as always.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Of course. Everybody, you've been listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can be sure to rate, review, subscribe over on Blog Talk or on iTunes, and go Orange this weekend. Beat the Terps.
Go Orange. Go Orange.